Okay, well, I think the time has ticked over, so we're going to just get this session underway, and thank you very much in advance for your attendance. And the investment approach to social welfare is what we're going to be hearing about today, and it's grown in prominence in various fields. I think in New Zealand and I think in Australia as well in recent years. And you may have come across it, if not through your work or other areas. The Actuary of the Year, not Sarah, but previously was given his award for the work done in the investment approach. And so it's a very interesting topic, and I think it's a perfect example of how actuaries have been thinking differently in recent years. I have three bios here because we have three great presenters, but I'm not going to read you out the individual bios, and I'm just going to introduce Rosie Wynn, Angeli Napoli, have I said that right, and Mike Clough. Who are all from PricewaterhouseCoopers and have been working on this important engagement for the government and particularly the Department of Social Services in support of the Australian Priority Investment Approach to Welfare. And so you've been to enough of these sessions. We're going to hold questions until the end, and I'll just remind you of the protocols there. But without further ado, please welcome our speakers, and I'll invite Angeli to kick off.
Thanks, Lindsay, and thanks for describing the room as having too many chairs and not too few people. Much appreciated. All right, so let's start. A new flexible social support system that is simpler, sustainable, coherent and outcomes focused, with investments directed towards achieving clear, measurable improvements for people at risk of income support reliance. So that's one of the key recommendations from the McClure Review of the Australian Welfare System. We're really excited and proud to be part of the activities being undertaken to improve the social welfare system in Australia. And today we'll be talking about some of the work we've been doing with the federal government to support policy development through the investment approach to social welfare. The investment approach to social welfare represents a shift from designing welfare programs from a focus on outputs to a focus on outcomes. Many older and even current programs were not designed with a strong focus on outcomes. So, for example, the Work for the Dole program was initially designed in response to feedback from the community that young unemployed people should undertake their mutual obligation in order to receive income support payments. The investment approach can be thought of as activity undertaken by the government on the basis of a return on investment. The provision of funding is then based on data to understand the issues or needs, whether the proposed program is likely to address the needs, and evaluation and reporting of the outcomes achieved by the programs. So instead of focusing on what was delivered, the focus is on the outcomes achieved and whether they provide a good return on investment. So what is the investment approach? The investment approach is the term being used to describe a new approach governments are using when they are planning and delivering programs. To date, it's been used in welfare, and we'll talk more as the session progresses about its broader applications. The concepts underpinning the approach will be familiar to most actuaries, so they draw on actuarial concepts such as the control cycle, looking at a whole-of-population or whole-of-system view, valuing programs as net present values, and so forth. So the concepts are not new, they're just being applied in a different environment and being considered by a group of stakeholders such as policy experts and program administrators who typically have not applied such concepts in the course of their roles. So why use it? Historically, many government programs have focused on funding outputs rather than outcomes. An example would be numbers of treatments, hours of service activity, or dollars of benefit. When program costs are under pressure, the levers available are reducing access through tightened program eligibility or reducing average spend through benefit caps, say. Governments typically undertake program evaluations to see whether they're economically valuable. Despite this, programs don't always deliver on the intended social or financial outcomes. Indeed, despite good intentions by all involved, it seems that for some programs, a discussion of target outcomes is not a core part of the program design, and these considerations somehow get lost along the way. The investment approach represents an increased focus on program funding on the basis of return on investment and aims to reduce avoidable spending in the longer term. It's worth highlighting that in this social context, returns broader than a pure financial return, it would include health and social considerations. So it's not just about reducing the liability if someone exits the welfare system, but it's about understanding what's happened to them after that and whether the program has mattered in improving their lifetime well-being. Of course, the premise is that the two go hand in hand. By aiming to deliver better social outcomes, we reduce the financial pressures on the system. So turning to Australia, why has the federal government implemented this approach? We have clear budgetary pressures, and the rate of growth in welfare spend has and is projected to grow greater than the rate of growth in government revenue. Thus, avoidable social welfare spending has become a focus of the federal government, and there's interest in finding better ways to balance spending and revenues, and interest in helping people lead better lives. Many of the largest government programs relate to welfare. For example, the 2014 National Commission of Audit report examined the 15 largest and fastest growing government programs and saw that age pension was the largest, disability pension is substantial, and carers payment is amongst the fastest growing. The report noted that all of the major programs were going faster than both inflation and revenues. Spending on the MBS, PBS and hospital are also in the top 15 and growing, and the NDIS is another area of expenditure experiencing rapid growth. So you can see on the slide here, at 30 June 15, about half of the Australian resident population had had an interaction with the welfare system at some point during their lives, with about a third of the population receiving welfare during the latest year, during 14-15. The chart in the middle shows actual welfare spend over time, and the latest year is a bit lower because some payments are made after the end of the financial year. The chart doesn't include health and veterans payments, but when you include those, the total welfare spend in 14-15 was $146 billion. This represents 35% of the total budget and 8% of GDP. And the pie chart shows the distribution of spend by the various benefit types, and age pension accounts for about a third of total welfare spend. Welfare spend is anticipated to grow to $227 billion over the next decade due to a longer living and larger population. So a bit of history. The investment approach to reform was originally developed by the New Zealand government in response to a review on welfare dependency conducted by the Welfare Working Group. The group's primary task was to identify how to reduce long-term welfare dependency. Part of their terms of reference was to consider insurance principles and approaches. Since 2011, annual actuarial valuations of the lifetime costs of working-age welfare recipients have been conducted, and these valuations have been used as the basis of social welfare changes in New Zealand, and Rosie will discuss some of the more recent developments in New Zealand later. The McClure report into the review of Australia's welfare system was released in February 15. The report contained various recommendations based on a four-pillar approach to reforming the welfare system, and these four pillars were a simpler and sustainable income support system, strengthening individual and family capability, engaging with employers, and building community capacity. One of the recommendations was that an investment approach similar to the one being introduced in New Zealand be adopted, with an actuarial approach being used to identify groups at risk of long-term income support reliance. The Australian priority investment approach was funded in the May 15 budget, and the first actuarial valuation was implemented at June 15. So how are actuaries involved? The term investment approach is being used by an increasing number of people, and it clearly has different meanings in different contexts. So for clarity here, we're primarily referring to the role played in the Australian welfare work. In this context, actuaries have played a pivotal role in developing the actuarial valuation. drawing on techniques from a range of actuarial disciplines to underpin the modelling. We've employed general insurance principles, survival models, statistical models, net present values, mortality, simulation modelling, etc. However, the investment approach is much broader than just the actuarial valuation. To be effective, it needs to include the full range of activities that complete the control cycle. So on the slide here, the darker shaded boxes are the areas where actuaries are typically involved. The approach requires supporting data to understand individual recipients and how they interact with the welfare system over the longer term. It requires the implementation of programs and interventions that are designed to meet the individual's needs and deliver improved financial and non-financial outcomes. As always, monitoring is an important part of the control cycle to understand the key drivers of experience and whether the welfare system is delivering its target outcomes and is sustainable. As interventions are applied to target groups, outcomes are monitored, programs are evaluated to identify what works and what doesn't, with the results of the evaluations informing decisions on whether programs are continued, dropped, or scaled up. So over the next few slides, we'll give you an overview of the actuarial model of the Australian welfare system that we've developed for the Department of Social Services, and we'll also take you through some of the key results from our baseline valuation.
Thank you. So I'm going to go through some of the model and results, and this will be based on the results I'll show are based on the June 2015 baseline valuation, which we've completed and was published by the Department of Social Services on their website. So starting off, I wanted to show a profile of the model population. And I like a good chart, and this one's one of my favourites, so I thought I'd talk about this a bit. So we model the full resident population of Australia, which is shown here in the population pyramid. There's 23.9 million people, and we've shown the population by age going up the vertical axis for males on the left and females on the right. The shape of the population, you can see there's various features, and that's impacted really by past births and deaths as well as past migration. So the colours then show information about people's recent welfare expenditure, and the first six colours, which are blue, green, orange, pink, purple and red, indicate people who've used an income support payment over the last year, so people who've received one of the higher payments. The next three colours, which are the lighter shades of orange and pink as well as brown, indicate people who've recently received a supplementary payment, so one of the lower payments. And then the two shades of yellow show people who are not receiving any welfare payments, with the lighter shade of yellow being people who have never received a welfare payment, at least in our data, which covers the last 15 years. And the darker yellow shows people who've received something in the last 15 or so years but aren't currently receiving anything. So a few features of this chart. Around a third of all people in Australia, or 8 million people, are the non-yellow colours, so have received some type of welfare in the last year. Going from bottom to top, you'll see below age 15, it's pretty much all yellow. So whilst there are several payments in respect of children, the parent or guardian would be the recipient, and so that information would go with the parent or guardian. Moving up, you'll see a dark blue circle kind of zone at around the late teens and into the 20s, which is people receiving a studying income support payment, which is called AusStudy. Through the middle ages, there's an interesting feature. So there's quite a marked difference between males and females at this age, and so there's a lot more females are receiving family-type payments, and so there's the darker orange, which is parenting payment, and then the lighter orange, which is the family tax benefit. Conversely, you'll see there's more males who are receiving the working age New Start payment, which is for job seekers. And then moving up towards retirement, and you'll see at the top there's a very large red area, which is everybody receiving the age pension above age 65. So on to a bit about the model. The model projects the pathways of every individual in Australia as they move in and out of the welfare system. So the two main inputs to that, one of them is the population data set I was describing, and so that contains a record for every person, and it contains information such as their demographics, so age, gender, education, family circumstances, as well as their welfare use. So that's the population data set. And then the other main input is the assumptions, which are used in order to project these characteristics forward from year to year. And these assumptions, of course, setting these assumptions depends on looking at the longitudinal history, and this type of work really relies on that kind of information to be able to get started. So the model then is a simulation model which projects the pathway of every Australian going in and out of welfare, and it projects people's pathways from the valuation date through to their death. And we project one simulation for every person, so 23.9 million simulations in the headline results. And this is something we can vary as well, so we can project multiple simulations per person. The outputs then, the headline output shown there is the projected pathways of individuals, but this can also be summarised in different ways, so we could look at total costs or other kinds of outputs, and I'll show you a few of those in a bit. The projection's quite complicated, so I thought it might be worth stepping through an example of the cycle. And this cycle happens for every individual and for every year going forward. So as an example, if we thought about, say, a 35-year-old male with an English accent. So the model starts with their characteristics and then projects them forward one by one. And you'll see the first blue arrow shows the simulation of demographic and other life circumstances. So the first thing in the chain is aging, so that's pretty straightforward. I will be 36 next year. There's also a probability of survival, which hopefully is pretty high. Next in the chain is the change in the highest level of education, and so there's assumptions around that. The assumptions are relevant for individuals, so they will depend on my age and gender, as well as other history such as education and welfare. And then there's a update of partnering status, and again, the assumptions will depend on my individual characteristics. So I'm recently married, and the model would give me a fairly high probability of staying that way. This is then followed by an update of whether I have a child over the next year. I'll leave Angela and Rosie to continue to speculate. So that's the end of the characteristics update, and then it moves on to the update of welfare information. This is encompassed by a few different features. So there's the welfare class, which defines the primary welfare use of a person, and this could be a welfare category or could be no welfare. So this is first simulated. Then there's a utilisation, which allows for people to utilise any of the possible payment types. So it allows for people to receive multiple different payments in the same year. And then given someone utilises a payment type, there's an average payment size. So because of the way the chain works, all the probabilities must be conditional on the ones beforehand. So when my class is simulated, that would depend on my updated education level and child status. And so, for instance, if I received or was projected to receive New Start next year, New Start allowance, and that would complete the cycle, and we would move on to that, the end of the characteristics at the end of that cycle would then form the kind of baseline for starting the next one. So, on to some of the results. As I said, the model outputs the projected pathways for every individual, and these can be summarised in different ways. So you could look at information on the pathways alone. So, for instance, you might want to look at the proportion of the population in each future year who is projected to receive the age pension. The main headline figure is from adding adding these projections up and the costs up to come up with an actuarial liability, which we've termed the lifetime cost. You could also look at characteristics which are relevant or predictive of people as having different outcomes, such as high lifetime costs. And finally, it provides a baseline. So this valuation can be done year on year, and if there were policy changes over the year, we can look at what impact a policy change has had on the full lifetime cost. The lifetime cost from the June 2015 valuation was $4.8 trillion, which is obviously a very large number. It's 40 times the annual welfare expenditure and many multiples of the annual budget. So it's not a figure that you'd ever think about pre-funding, but it's useful to understand. Around half of this cost relates to the cost of future age pension payments, and then the next largest component is the cost of future disability support pension payments. Probably the more important thing, though, rather than looking at this total, is understanding how different cohorts vary and the average lifetime costs for different cohorts vary. So, the total lifetime cost of $4.8 trillion works out to be an average of $200,000 for each and every person in Australia, so it's still a very large figure. The largest group in our model is the group of people who have not received welfare. So that's about two-thirds of the population, or 16 million people. And I've shown a chart on the left here of the lifetime cost of that group by age and also by gender, with males on the left and females on the right. So the average cost of this group is around $160,000. And you'll see it's reasonably steady between people of different ages. And there's probably two main components. So there's a red component, which is by far the largest component for this group, and that's the cost of future age pension payments. And then the other colours represent a cost of a different payment, which would have a probability, but albeit a lower probability, of occurring. And I've also shown, to contrast this, the lifetime cost of the current group of disability support pensioners. So the average for this group is much larger. It's around $420,000. And there's two main payments made up in this lifetime cost. So there's the purple, which shows the cost of future disability support pension, and then red again, which shows the cost of future age pension payments. But in the modelling, there are cohorts with lifetime costs of $500,000 and plus. And we pulled out a few examples in our baseline report, and some of those, for instance, are the group of young parents, group of young carers, and also a group of studying payment recipients who, instead of transitioning into work after completing their study, they transition to receiving the New Start income support payment. So here's another example of a cohort output from the valuation model. And this looks at the projection of the people who received a studying payment at the valuation date. So there were 392,000 people in receive of a studying income support payment, the main one being I'll study. On the right, I've shown the age profile, and you can see it's, as you'd expect, it's a pretty young group. It's mostly people in their 20s. And then on the left, I've shown a picture of the how this group is projected forward. So blue indicates people who are receiving a studying payment, and by definition in this group, 100% of the group are receiving a studying payment at the start. And you'll see as the projection goes forward, the blue zone drops off pretty quickly, so people move away from receiving a studying payment over the first 10 years or so. Yellow indicates people who are no longer receiving a welfare payment, and this goes up pretty quickly to over 50% over the first few years. Black then shows people who are projected to have died by a future year, and this, it's quite far into the distance when that becomes significant because we have a young group. The green group is one of the groups I was talking about before. So this is people they've started off in studying payment and they've transitioned to receive the working age new start allowance. And you can see here there's quite a lot of people who have gone through that path over the first few years. Probably the other interesting feature here is if you look at the bottom six colours there, so blue up to red, so that's all the people who are projected to receive an income support payment, and in any future year that's for this group, that's at least 25%, which was quite a surprising result. Okay, I'm now going to hand over to Rosie, who's going to talk through some uses of the model as well as some of the challenges.
Thanks, Mike. So, how is this all being used? Oh, wrong way. Great. Really, it forms an evidence base to support policy and program development for the department. The data itself that we've developed is longitudinal, and it's quite powerful. So it can be explored. So we can look at current welfare recipients, and we can see their journeys through the system so far, when they first joined the system, how they've tracked through the different payment types, and sort of understand that experience. We can use that in data to see what's actually worked. So when they've had programs that have been run in the past, which programs have worked and for which types of people. And then turning that around the other way, which sort of attributes do people have that have had poorer outcomes? So how can we look at those different subgroups within the population? The model is able to provide information both at the sort of macro and the micro level. So at the whole of system level, Mike's shown you how it estimates the future costs, and it also can be the output because it's an annual simulation. We can show year-on-year expenditures. So that can help show how we're expecting things to trend into the future and the pressures on different payment types, and help inform budgets and show the underlying drivers of each payment type. It can also show how much that system cost is just driven by simple population demographics, and really say that question of, well, under the current policy, what will happen, and therefore, you know, help inform decisions around, do we actually need to change current policy if we can't afford that, or what levers should the policymakers press? At the micro level, it's sort of really interesting what the model can show. So the model works for groups of similar people, and we have a sort of almost design criteria that as long as you have about 1,000 people in a group, it's reasonably reliable from our testing. And it can show the expected outcomes for those people. So costs is interesting, but also just understanding how persistent people are in the system and that profile of welfare usage, like Mike showed in the chart before. And that really helps understand which groups of people are really reliant on welfare for a lot of their lives versus those people who are expected to become more self-sufficient a lot of the time. So, and as I sort of said, you can subdivide the population into groups so you can sort of see the effect of different attributes. So we could, for example, look at people who are students and their outcomes for people who are currently single versus people who are couples or people who are parents, and actually understand how the outcomes are likely to be different for people in those different situations. So one particular example of the use is the TriTest and Learn Fund. So this fund was established following the 2016 budget, and it was really the government's first sort of formal response to the investment approach model. So its aim is to support trials of new and innovative policy to help people live independently of welfare. And it's particularly seeking to support groups of people who have the capacity to work and are at risk of long-term welfare dependence, so using that information from the model around expected persistency in the system. It's being driven by an outcomes-focused approach to policy development. Policy ideas were sought from a broad range of sources, including the community sector, government, academics, and business. And the department's got on their website around nearly 400 ideas that were submitted as part of the first wave of this fund. The most suitable ideas are then being selected, and we'll progress onto a process of co-development, selection of delivery partners, and then delivery and evaluation. So the focus of this fund is really on helping to understand and build empirical evidence around what works for different groups of people. So we've got an approach here where the model's showing who needs interventions, and then the TTL fund's trying out things, because I think it's well recognised within the department that a lot of these groups are not new. I mean, people know that young parents have needed support, but despite lots of effort over the years, nobody's really figured out what works best. So it's trying to help build a really strong evidence base with rigorous evaluation and using some of the work in the data to support that. Okay. Changing tack slightly, I thought it'd be interesting just to share some of the challenges that we encountered throughout this sort of course of this project. I know it's sort of an emerging field, and quite a lot of people are always asking me around this work and have some degree of interest. So we really had sort of two types of challenges that we worked through over the course of developing the model, and half of them were in a kind of traditional technical bucket, and then the other half were really, I think, more symptomatic of working in a new field and with different stakeholders. So really, in terms of the model side of things, I think it was a new model, so there were no really standard ways of doing things, and we were starting from first principles in trying to ensure that the design of the model we built was fit for purpose. In this case, the core purpose was actually helping understand which people can be invested in to have better life outcomes. So it wasn't a core financial purpose. But at the same time, there were many stakeholder agencies, and we were highly aware that a lot of those other agencies would be very, very interested in the financial information produced by the model. So thinking about that purpose led to some of the choices that we made in the design. For example, thinking about the results information helped us understand the scope of the model that would be required, which people to include, which types of payments, and at what level of granularity in the modelling. We thought about using different time periods for the projection. The work done in New Zealand just models people up to retirement age, and some other models might work from we could have started at age 15 and just modelled from there up, given that most of the welfare payments go to adults. But overall, we agreed a final design that showed the full resident population and really every payment that the department had admin responsibility for, plus childcare payments, which they had at the time we designed the model, and then that responsibility got transferred to a different department subsequent, but we kept that in scope. One of the reasons for including the full population is we knew that the cost for people not currently receiving welfare was not zero, and that really welfare is an almost insurance policy for the population. It's there to support you if you fall on bad times in your life, and that if we're going to make comments around the cost of some of the disadvantaged, high-risk, high-needs groups, then it's not fair to implicitly compare that to zero. You need to understand actually what's the cost for somebody who's not currently a welfare recipient. Okay. In terms of the implementation, it's a big, complex model. And I'd say don't underestimate the work involved in building that. And just sort of to touch on a couple of pieces, we had to build longitudinal data to support all the modelling. And we started with nearly between 250 and 300 individual data sets of episodic data that either showed a particular payment period, payment and the period for which it was due for an individual, or the attributes of a person. And so it took quite a lot of coding just to turn that into longitudinal data, and large data sets as well, given the numbers of people involved. One of the other challenges we had in terms of the data was just understanding well enough for the modelling what information is collected when and for whom, that just because a variable exists in the data set, and we obviously want to use that in the modelling so that we can examine all the attributes, but knowing who is it collected for, at what point, as part of which entry to which payment, and how reliable is it for different subgroups of the population. Is it something we knew about for everyone, or could we only model it for a subgroup of people? So, for example, we didn't have a lot of information on educational attainment apart from for people who had been students at some point in their history. In terms of the modelling, I mean, it's a complex model, and it's a simplification of the real world, like any model. We really wanted to make sure that it wasn't oversimplified and that the parameters were well fit. And that we thought there was a big risk because of the nature of the simulation, that one year's outputs become the inputs for the next part, that if 1 year is a little bit wrong, that kind of gap could grow year on year and have a very geared effect, so the longer term results could be quite inaccurate. So that was something that we thought was a real challenge for the model itself, trying to make sure they were results were sensible both for the whole population and for each cohort within it. And there was no real awesome way we found of making sure that worked. You know, it would be lovely to have the answer of how do you project 40 years into the future and know it's right. You can't do comparisons into the future. But what we actually came up with was a whole scorecard of validation checks for the model. And so where we could, we sort of went through each thing going, what's the best available comparative reference data? So, for example, we made a lot of use of population data to sort of answer questions like, when people are 30, 40, 50, and 60, what percentage of people are partnered and single? And there's really good data on the census for that. And then what are fertility rates at different ages? You know, what are death rates and what might that mean for people separating at older ages? So using all those sources, we could think of using a lot of ABS data and census data and surveys and HILDA data and so forth. And we also did a lot of back testing. So we sort of ran the model 4 years before we started and then sort of saw what happened and compared it to actual versus expected testing in that way. Okay. I think the other types of challenges were more said symptomatic of working in a new field. And I think the biggest one for me was just communication. We were working with an agency who had a lot of people who are extremely, extremely experienced in their field, but their field is social policy. And often they come either from a political, social work, or almost health background, and didn't necessarily have much training in financial information. So their experience was usually working bottom-up from being in the field or looking at individual cases, and looking at things from a sort of top-down portfolio view was something that they didn't necessarily find easy. And things like net present values or liabilities were concepts that we sort of had to start at the beginning and explain even why would you want to do that. You know, they'd been working on four-year budgeting financial expenditures rather than looking at lifetime cost measures. So one of the techniques we used to do that was we developed a lot of visualizations. So things like Mike showed you with the population of ways of representing the data. And then we started trying to join the dots. So at times I'd find a recent policy change and then show some charts of what that policy change did to the data to sort of help join the dots between what they understood as this change will impact this group of people in this way and then what it did to all people receiving student payments and how many of them were affected and help build that up. But it was certainly is hard, was hard, and you had to invest a lot of time in things that you wouldn't if you were doing insurance company type work or working for a CFO or other people who are used to working with actuaries. The other challenge was there's no professional guidelines for this type of work. I mean, we looked around and yes, there's the code of conduct and we made reference to that and we found one international standard, but really we were working from scratch in terms of developing assumptions. So for example, when we were looking at discount rates, working out what was the right discount rate to use. You know, we're not going to hold assets, so you don't want to benchmark against assets. We looked at work that had been done for NDIS, for the Intergenerational Report, for the Ghana Report, and a lot of different points. So there's no particular right answer, but we did have to spend time and have a lot of conversations about things that in other bits of work would just be roll out a fairly recognised approach. But it was good going on that journey with the client and helping work through those things together. Just to finish, I just want to touch on some of the developments of investment approach modelling in Australia and New Zealand. So as we've shown here, investment approach is really about using life pathway modelling of individual person level data and to help organisations better understand the populations they support and provide information to help them do a better job in terms of targeting resources to deliver outcomes. The welfare models have been in use in both Australia now and New Zealand for a couple of years. And really those two models are pretty similar. They're looking at welfare utilisation and welfare lifetime costs. I think what's interesting is quite a few of the other models that are either in place or under development have moved away from having a focus on liabilities as an outcome measure. And I guess this is recognising that reducing costs is not necessarily the objective of some of the agencies who are commissioning this work. So some of the outcomes that are useful are things that are about understanding patterns of service use, the drivers of the system trends, and helping understand variations in level of needs. So, for instance, the New Zealand investment approach for their justice department is actually exploring the burden of crime on the population. So which people in the population commit different types of offences, and so the ministry can help understand what levers they can use to reduce the overall societal burden of crime. I think finally I just want to touch on the vulnerable children model in New Zealand, and that model's really come about from a recognition that there's a very disadvantaged group of children in society who have a much higher prevalence of poor outcomes than other groups in the population. And so that model is really about helping understand what can be done to better support that group of children through the early part of their lives and help them achieve better outcomes. So again, that's very much focusing on understanding indicators of poor life outcomes rather than anything to do with liabilities, but applying the same underlying concepts. So it'll be really interesting to see how this all develops as the years go on, and I think it's a massive opportunity for the actuarial community to get involved and use our skills to support government. So thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Rosie and Mike and Anjali. And we'll watch with interest as Mike progresses through year by year. And we'll look forward to receiving updates regularly. You've got us on the edge of our chair now. So we have time for a few questions, comments. Please make your way to the microphone and just give your name and where you're from. Thanks. Julia.
Hi, everyone. Julia Lessing from Guardian Actuarial. Thanks, guys. That was really, really interesting. And as you know, I'm really excited about this work. So I think it's great for us to hear about the work that you've been doing. And I can't imagine how many late nights you would have spent building that model. I've got two questions for you. One's a technical one and one's a soft one. On the technical side, I'm conscious that with welfare payments, you know, a lot of payments are based on individuals and an individual circumstance, but some are kind of household or, you know, family-type, means-tested type, you know, family tax benefit, for example. So I was just wondering how, from a technical perspective, you manage the assumptions around that if you're modelling individuals, but knowing that they're kind of part of a family. And the second question was that you guys must know the most, more than anyone else about Australia and their welfare habits. And I was just wondering, each of you must have come across something that kind of stood out as a really interesting fun fact as you were putting all this data together that you hadn't thought about before. And I was wondering if you had any of those to share with us.
Maybe we'll take the factual question first.
I think in terms of allowing for different things. I mean, the model as it currently stands works at an individual person level, so we don't have partner attributes. And I certainly recognise that the transfer system works at a household level, but we do have partner status and children, and we also have a lot about the person's history. So we were really using those variables to understand as best we could how that impacts use of welfare. And what we found is across our, I think Mike showed in our sort of what we call the wheel diagram, the circle of arrows, that, you know, once somebody's on a main payment, we then look at use of other payments and we look at payment amounts. And we have GLM type models for each of those things. So using both the person's history and their characteristics, we actually found it was quite predictive. And we weren't just using average payment amounts, we were taking into account partner status and other things. So like for FTB, number of children, partner status and so forth would all influence your annual payment. Fun facts, I might put that one on hold for the time being.
We tried to anticipate the type of questions we get. We did not anticipate that one.
Perhaps you can catch up on that one over afternoon tea. Please, Colin, use the microphone. Thanks.
maybe not a fun fact quite, but just a learning for me was actually just how much insight we got from not the kind of flashy forward projection model, but just from spending a lot of time looking at the past data and doing, we thought of lots of different ways of charting the past data, and we got a lot of insights from that. And actually, I think the department were not used to our way of thinking and using longitudinal data, so I think there's a lot of value just came out of that process.
Colin Renfield, I think for this question I should disclose what hat I'm wearing. I'm asking the question as convener of the Institute Superannuation Projection and Disclosure Committee. I asked the question because you made a comment that there was no guidance on how to do a lot of this work, which I'm sure is true, but there is a Institute Practice Guideline 499.02 on superannuation projections and modelling. And it has a lot of relevance to particularly the way that the results are communicated. And just to give you one example, I assume that the annual costs that you're quoting are in today's dollars. And I ask the question, are those today's dollars discounted at CPI, or are they discounted at average weekly ordinary times earnings, or are they discounted in some other manner? And just as a suggestion, I think you should be doing both.
Thanks for the question. The lifetime cost values we showed are sort of net present values, so they're discounted, and they're discounted at a rate that was agreed with the department. And we spent a long time on this, and the work's actually governed by a steering committee of federal government departments, and had a lot of input from Federal Treasury. And the approach that was decided was to use a fixed long-term rate that was consistent with what government used for a number of other long-term calculations, and the rate was 6% in this, which... Did we? I think, though, if we did, they were probably historical inflated right at the beginning on the welfare spend.
No, on Angela's slide.
Yeah, that's just historical in historical dollars, just straight out of accounts.
Thank you. We've probably, even though the bill has gone, we haven't had the final bill, so Martin.
Martin Mulcair. Great presentation, fascinating, and obviously a powerful model. So I'm thinking about applications. So let me give you two naive questions. The first... Just imagine, hypothetically, that there is a charity that's got a program that they think is going to have a beneficial impact on, whatever, name your favourite style of payment. Obviously, being able to test the potential value of that, either to get support from government or get support from the private sector, seems to me a useful thing to do. So, naive question, to what extent, if any, is the model available for that purpose?
I think that the model isn't available to people outside of the department. I think the department's doing a release of the data underpinning the model in various forms to selected researchers for various questions, and via, I think it's the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, in a sort of de-identified form. I mean, there's obviously a lot of privacy issues when you're dealing with individual person data, and they're sort of very cognizant of the requirements that they have as a government department. So there's been a lot of inquiries recently on data, and they're working through them, but it's very much, at the minute, it's not publicly available in full for those sort of reasons.
Okay. Naive question number two. Mark, we've had some interesting conversations with people who are involved facilitating social impact bonds or variations on that theme. So again, the idea of how best to measure the impact of a particular program to demonstrate the value of the investment for the social impact bonds. So you're obviously not using the model there, but and there may be people in the room know more than me about, in fact, quite likely someone in the room knows more than me about such things. But I'm just interested in what PwC knows about measurement tools and how that might be different to this investment approach for those purposes. Does that make sense?
Sorry, what the question is, what does PwC know about social investment bonds? Or
Well, you can ask the answer, but no, what you know about the way that those types of outcomes are measured to demonstrate the value of an investment in the social impact bonds.
Yeah, I mean, I'm across a little bit on social investment bonds, and I think the measurement of outcomes is not so much challenging in itself, but making sure that you've got an appropriate benchmark and a right comparator group, because obviously the financial return is so directly linked once the bond's set up to the outcomes measurement. So knowing how reliable that is, I think, is the challenge. There's uncertainty in any measurement, and to me, it's that standardisation for the group of people. I think it's one of the things that we've found in looking at programme outcomes is a lot of the groups are actually receiving multiple different interventions at any one time, so isolating the impact of one thing or another is hard. So I don't think I've really answered the question as you wanted, but probably the best as I can do at the moment.
I guess just to clarify, it seems that you have put a lot of robust thinking into this, and just whether that robust thinking could be applied to some of those other challenges. That's all right. Thank you.
I suspect the answer is yes, it can be, and I view this work, even though I've got no experience in it, I view this work as really at the very outset of a whole new approach that where its value will be in its repeated use and its testing of things and giving insights. I think one of the challenges is in communicating, and I remember some of the press releases and media releases that the department did at the time the report was published, and of course the focus was in the you know, the present value of the liabilities number, which was what, 4 trillion or something or other, and so the media says, well, you know, how can people understand that and what does it mean? But I think there's great opportunity here, and great to see the government doing this, and I think it's a perfect example of how actuaries are using their skills to think differently. So that's all we have time for, and thank you very much for attending and for your interested remarks and comments. But of course, most thanks to our presenters. But just before I let you go, a reminder, fill in your feedback. The prizes are about to be drawn. There may be an opportunity for you to quickly get an entry in, and of course, join me in thanking Anjali, Mike and Rosie for a very interesting presentation. Thank you.